revisioning activism, bringing depth, dialogue, and diversity to individual and social change. You're talking about that internal voice that we have going, that inner critic or whatever you want to call it. And I remember in that example of my own weight and my own struggle with that, years ago, maybe 20 years ago, I had a little bit of success on one particular diet, and I had lost about 10 pounds. And I was feeling really good about it. And as I walked past the bathroom mirror, I caught a glimpse of myself through the corner of my eye, and I saw a smaller person. And I heard an internal voice. I actually heard it as an auditory voice. I mean, I don't usually hear inner voices, but this time I heard it as an actual voice. And it said to me, "How will you now be powerful?" And I got the insight at that time, oh my goodness, there's something in me that is equating the bigness of my body with my power. At that time, I couldn't get over it. Any psychological sort of work that I could do just couldn't push me over the edge of combating that voice that equated my physical body weight with power. Mm-hmm. So what would you say?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of two things. One is some women, I'm a man talking about women, I just have to say that because... But some women, especially women who have been hurt young, abused young, end up creating big bodies. I'm saying it carefully because it's not everybody. You have to look at individuals. But many women have abuse histories and get a large body. And if I said, what's it like to have a large body? And I could get them past, well, it's terrible. I'm a terrible person. I can get them past the criticism of that. They would say... something like, it feels like a big cushion, armor, protection around me. And that way, there's an intelligence. I'm not saying that's the best way to do it, but there's an intelligence, a manifestation of protection happening in the body. Again, not consciously. I'm not sitting there thinking, I'm going to eat a lot so men won't be attracted to me. Some women actually do think that consciously, but very few do. But many are comforted knowing that their men are going to hit on them less, come near them less, and that they feel this sense of moat, protection, cushioning between them and the world.
That goes into the whole way that you do depth psychology. You would then, rather than saying, oh, this is a symptom we have to get rid of, a large body because it's not healthy, so we're going to get rid of this symptom. What you would do is to look at the benefit that is being derived from that symptom. Mm,
that's right.
So the benefit, go ahead.
Yeah, if that woman tells me that, look, and gets to that spot where she can reveal that insight, I feel safer in the world with this body, I have to say to her, what can we do to help you feel safer in the world before I say, let's get rid of the weight? She's saying to me, being safe in the world is more important to me than my health. Her body is saying that to me. She's giving me that message. I have to take that deadly serious and say, how do you do that? And what's going to be the answer? That goes back to what you were saying, Justine. How do I create the power to push people back, to set a boundary, to say no, to say this is my physical space I'm going to take up. This is the emotional space I'm going to take up. I have to now do consciously with my own empowered sense, with agency, what my body was once doing not terribly well, make space between me and people and make me feel safe.
Well, exactly. There you go. There you go. I really see that. I'd love to talk about, I know that you mentioned one of your mentors early on that has inspired you through the years, and that's Dr. Maya Angelou. And I was wondering, what is it about her that just grabbed you and inspired you very early on?
This is an amazing thing. The first, I went to see her many times before she passed. And the first time I went to see her, she opened her mouth. She said hello. I think it was in 7 languages. I didn't know much about her. She hadn't offered me any content. She just used her voice. And I started weeping. I thought, why am I weeping? She hasn't said anything yet. There was something about the sound, the tone of her voice And if I could have put words to it, I would say, oh, that's what an authentic voice sounds like. I didn't have those words, but something touched me. And then later I learned her story, that when she was, I'm going to get the ages wrong, I think she was 5 or 6, and then she was raped. And young black girl in the South, she's raped. And then she's thinking, should I tell, I want to say it's my uncle. Should I tell?
Think if I just read it, that I think it was her uncle that she told.
Yeah. Should I tell him? Oh my gosh, maybe something will bad happen. And she tells the uncle. And then sometime later, a knock on the door comes. It's the sheriff. And they find the man who abused her dead. And she concludes in her child's mind, I caused this person's death. I shouldn't speak. My voice can do things. This alone, back to our conversation, Justine, is such a big thing. My voice is so powerful, it could kill. On the downside, she didn't cause this person's death. That's like a bad thing for her to psychologically think, etc. On the positive side, she does have a very powerful voice. If you hear her read poems, it can shake you. It can rattle your soul a bit. So she does have a powerful voice. But then she doesn't speak for like 5.5 years, 6 years. And her grandmother, who she called Mama, says, don't worry, you're going to be a great teacher someday. She cooks something inside of herself. The grandmother is able to do two things. One, a traditional thing. Oh my gosh, my granddaughter's hurt. Let's protect her. And grandmother was very protective of her. And then the second thing, a more depth thing. Something's growing in that silence. That doesn't dismiss the fact that she was hurt, badly injured. That has to be taken very seriously. And what's happening in this strange way that she deals with it by speaking up, thinking her voice caused something terrible, and then becoming silent, and then having this voice raise up, which has this resonance. So when I heard that voice, I went and looked up, how did she develop that voice? Grandma, Mama, an injury, and like an alchemical chamber, we could say, a pot where somebody holds that, grandma holds that and says, something amazing is cooking in there. I'm going to hang out there. I'm not going to try to get you to speak yet. I'm going to just keep telling you something amazing is happening in that silent space you develop.
So she was like a depth psychologist.
The best of them.
she gave her a container that was safe, that she held the world out from hurting Maya, this young child, and she trusted her process.
Beautifully said. She trusts her process. And then she doesn't dismiss a single thing. I remember this story that Maya Angelou put out a cookbook. Speaking of food, she put out a cookbook. And she tells a story of when she was a child and she'd go to school and she would get teased by the students because she wasn't speaking. You're retarded, you're this, whatever, and all the insults that kids can throw at another person and make them feel bad. And one of the times the teacher agreed. I can't remember what the word was. Maybe the teacher said, yeah, she's a weirdo, she's retarded. And they used that word back then to mean something stupid or something like that. So she uses that word and she comes home crying to Mama. And Mama takes her to the school, gets in front of the classroom with the students and teacher there and smacks the teacher in the face. Then apologizes, said, I shouldn't have done that. Then takes Maya home and makes her her favorite chocolate cake. It takes her 4 hours to make this cake and says, this will never make up for what happened to you. That's not dismissing something. That's a person who is not thinking it's okay to be mistreated. She puts that in so deeply.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's so powerful. And and then you see Dr. Angelou years later just affecting the whole culture. I mean, so many of us have been touched by her life and her voice and her poetry and her writing and her acting and her artistry and on and on and on. She just has been a true mentor to show us how to live beyond the wounds that we carry.
Mm-hmm. It's part of understanding racism, especially for people who are not African American, not Native American, not brown skinned in some way, that in a study or understanding or working with one's own skin color, as a white person also, you can find not only I should be better, I should be a better white person, I can be an ally, I shouldn't be racist, all those things that I can learn, but you also get entrance to a world that has shadow, depth, struggle, suffering, blues, deep joys, creativity in one's own being. You can get a connection with your own soul, because here we are in America, a place that has a wound around racism, a big wound. What does it have to do with me as a person? Well, when I should be a better person and be awake, great. But then deeper than that, if I can connect with that wound, just like if I can connect with my own, a doorway is going to open to me, and I'm going to have to grow in ways that are going to be magnificent, more magnificent, I think, than any other development possibility one has as a white person, is to learn about racism inside and out and what it means to walk around in one's own body.
That's so well said. And that just reminds me the kind of dialogues that are needed in this time, to have the courage as, let's say, a white person in this culture, to have the courage to have a true, deep dialogue about racism. And one of the things you talk about in your book, in your writings, that I thought was really interesting, you talk about in the very beginning of this dialogue, and it's something I didn't realize, the first thing that one might need to do in within a group of people is to really define the word racism, because it can mean different things to different people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Some people would say anytime one targets a race, regardless of that race, and has a bias against that race, that would be racism. So you could be racist against white people, potentially. Because you could say white people are no good, they're evil, they're bad, etc. You could call that racism. One of the difficulties with using the word racism for that and racism against a black person, one of the difficulties with that is they're not exactly the same. So if I say, if a black person hates a white person because they're white, I hate white people, and a white person hurts a black person because they're black, I hate black people, they're equivalent. Making that statement as if they're equivalent, again, it dismisses something. There's a real difference. If there was a black person here, they should say, they would say, I would say for them if they didn't want to say, do you not know the difference between walking around in white skin and black skin, David? And if I said, no, I don't know the difference, then somebody should educate me.
You know, David, just to point out something, I had a dialogue like this within a group of people, and it was led by an African-American woman. And she said in this particular time, we spent a whole day together, and she said, the first thing I think about myself is I am a black person. That is number one. Before I think that I'm a woman, I'm a psychologist, I'm a workshop leader, I'm a writer, I'm anything else, I am a black person. And I know that there was not a white person in the room that could say the same. I'm here with David Bedrick. He's the author of Revisioning Activism, Bringing Depth, Dialogue, and Diversity to Individual and Social Change. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with David Bedrick. He's on the faculty of the Process Work Institute. He's an attorney, and he's the author of Revisioning Activism, Bringing Depth, Dialogue, and Diversity to Individual and Social Change. And David, we're talking about racism in particular, and I just mentioned an experience I had of a dialogue we were having, and I just made the comment that a white person would never describe themselves for the most part, as the first thing that comes out of their mouth, I am a white person, and then I am a woman, I am a radio producer, blah, blah, blah. But a black person might say, I am a black person first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's so many levels to what we're talking here. The president, I think actually he's no longer president, and her name escapes me. I'm sorry about that. He was the president of Spelman College, and she did a study, and she would, and the study said, fill out the statement, I am. And if you were black, you almost always wrote black. If you're a woman, about 60, 70% of the time, you wrote woman, right? If you're a white man, you said, I'm an attorney. I'm an athlete. I'm a person who loves Netflix, right? You didn't think about your skin color at all. So that has a number of points. One is if you're in darker skin, you don't have the privilege of forgetting your color. I can't say, I'm David.
At least in this culture, in the U.S. culture, right.
Thank you. Thank you for that. That's right. In the U.S. culture. And then on the downside, as a white person, I don't think about the fact I'm white. That's also a blind spot for me. So I think I'm just this individual walking around disconnected from all kinds of things. My own history, European history, for me, Jewish history, etc. That's likely to get lost. That will disconnect me from many of the things that are happening for me. I'll forget that what's happening for me is related to all kinds of things. I'll think everything is individual.
You have said there is no symptom that belongs only to the individual, whether that symptom is emotional, spiritual, physical, social, or financial. So that's a powerful statement, that no symptom is totally living on its own merit. It's embedded and webbed into this other part of all culture.
Mm-hmm. It's so important. I make that statement so strongly because I get so upset at people coming to me saying they have individual problems. They do. I have my cough, or I have my angers, or I have my anxieties or insecurities. That's all important. But we're so darn disconnected. And popular psychology especially has furthered that, because popular psychology has a racial bias in it. It's mostly white psychology. Many black people don't go to psychology for various reasons. I think that's one of them. So we get that disconnection. I'm a Jewish person. If I talked about my Jewish family history, I lived in a violent home. My father used fists and belts and things like that. And my mother was very disempowered. If I tell you that story and don't tell you about the Jewish background to the story, or learn myself what the Jewish background to that story is, I'm not going to understand what that was all about.
Well, I've heard, David, that there's a whole culture of next generation Jewish children who have grown up not in the Holocaust directly, but they are all affected because of the way it's held by their parents and their grandparents, either spoken about or not spoken about. Just there's a whole culture of this other generation of Jewish children.
Yes, I can tell literally within 5 to 10 minutes, if I have a Jewish client, and I work with many Jewish clients, I can tell you within 5, 10 minutes, if I'm 60, so if that person is close to my generation, 30, 40, 50, 60 even, I can tell you whether their parents spoke about the Holocaust and anti-Semitism or not. How do I know right away, even if they don't mention anything about it? There's a huge glaring hole that I'm looking at. They don't know what they're connected to, the way they talk about themselves, the way they criticize themselves, the way they don't defend themselves, the way they think they should be in the world. I can say, your parents never talked about the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. They'll say, how'd you know that?
But it's like not talking about the elephant in the room, and therefore the elephant exists in the room. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. You talked during one of the breaks about the secrets. This happens also if there's a family that has violence in the family, from, let's say, the grandparents and then the parents and then to your generation. And then if that secret, let's say somebody was sexually abused, let's say grandfather, I'm thinking of so many stories, was sexually abused the daughters, and then various things happen to certain people. Then I'll tell people, if I have a client, I'll say, have you talked to how old are your children? My children are 27. Have you talked to them about what you know? No. You should tell them. How come? Because there's a hole in their psyche. What does that mean? That means that they'll go out and get into situations and they won't recognize the signals. They won't recognize the communication. They won't know how to protect themselves. They'll even, in a way, this is a strange thing, say, look for situations that are dangerous almost to fill out the story. How could that possibly happen, Dave? It doesn't make any sense. They don't know anything. It happens reliably. You have to give me the protection I need. You have to give me the big body I need. You have to say, grandfather did this. This is how he did that. This is the stories in our family. And then when I walk out into the world, I'm going to recognize that. I'm going to be more awake to that. I'm going to be safer. You won't make me safer by not telling me. Although people try to do that, I'm out of good motive, but you can't do it that way.
I'm thinking of this strange analogy there, as you said that. I'm thinking of the analogy of it's safer to have a sharp knife than a dull one. If you're in cooking, if you have a sharp knife, you can trust, you can cut things really easily. If you have a dull knife, there's more of a tendency to hurt yourself. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know exactly what you're saying. I'm thinking of that in terms of our awareness. Our awareness has to grow and be sharp. Japanese post-war, post-Nagasaki, Hiroshima generation, a lot of the families did not want to tell their children because it was so awful. You get this hole in their psyche and they dream about those things and get into difficulties. The Germans who were one generation or two generations away from Nazi Germany, parents were like totally ashamed of granddad who was in Nazi student group, youth groups. But then that person ends up dreaming about that, having problems, even physical health problems. All kinds of stories happening. So you see that in Jews here, you see it in African Americans, you see it in Native Americans, you see it in Japanese post-World War II, you see that in Germans. You have to fill it in. That goes back to this issue. We're connected. Those stories have to be pulled in. We're not only isolated. If I'm depressed, we should talk about, am I a Jew? Am I a female? Am I a male? Am I black? Tell me about the family history. If I'm German, if I'm Native American, what does that mean? If I'm gay,
so
what does that mean about my depression and suicidality? It means something.
So we have to be inclusive. David, I'd love to have you talk about one other thing. I mean, we could go on. There's so many things, but I would love to have you touch on the fact of death and dying and, let's say, Alzheimer's and the other things that are going on with our loved ones as they pass on. And you had an experience with your own mother that was just such a beautiful story. I'd love for you to tell us how you coped with her alternate thinking, her alternative world, or her altered state.
My eyes get watery when you ask that. I didn't expect you to bring that up. That's fine to do. I have more feeling about that than I had realized. Yeah, my mother and I had a very strained relationship, partially because we lived in a violent home and she couldn't address it. She dismissed it, just like people dismiss social issues. This wasn't that big a deal, et cetera. It didn't really happen. So that made a very big strain between her and I. But towards the end of her life, her mind went, what people would say. She had some forms of dementia. And I remember one time I saw her in the last year. I was standing right across from her. And she said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Who do you think I am?" She says, "Well, I don't know who you are. I'm looking for my son." And she got very nervous. She clutched her handbag. That's what she would do, like I was some kind of bad person or something like that. But I always enjoyed when people were not in their quote-unquote normal minds. I like to dream. As a Jungian-oriented psychologist, I like to dream. So I would always just talk to her and go wherever she would go. I'd say, "Who do you think I am?" "I think you're the person on the ship." "What ship?" "The ship that we're cruising on." "Oh my gosh, where are we going?" "We're going to the islands in the Bahamas." "Oh my gosh, are we eating?" "No." "Are you having martinis?" She liked martinis. "Oh yeah, how good are they?" "Oh, I love it. They only put one olive in this." And then we would go off on these journeys together. I made up names for her. She made up names for me, not consciously. We had the sweetest time. It was all imaginal, but it's in a way more real feeling-wise. We were having more tenderness, warmth, love between each other than we had in our quote-unquote real conversations. The feelings were real. The details, somebody would say, are not.
And I think that, if I remember correctly, she even came to some point where she said, described you as being a really good person.
Mm, yeah. See, now you're getting to me again.
Yeah.
She did. We argued a lot about what went on in our family, and because she wanted to maintain this nothing went bad in the family attitude. And one day she said to me, how did you get to be such a good person? She said to me. And I thought it was one of those, the child in me was always waiting for her to think, oh my gosh, I always reached out to people and tried to help people. And she always looked at that as something that was not so worthy. And she used to say to me, stop trying to change the world, David. And my father said to me, you're a dreamer. I became a dream analyst and an activist. What choice did I have? Right?
Exactly, exactly. Well, I'm glad that you made the choices that you have. And I want to thank you so much, David, for being with us today. I've been here with David Bedrick. He's on the faculty of the Process Work Institute. He's an attorney, and he's the author of several books. One, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology, and also Revisioning Activism, Bringing Depth, Dialogue, and Diversity to Individual and Social Change. And if you'd like to know more about his work, you can go to his website, davidbedrick.com. He spells his last name B-E-D-R-I-C-K, davidbedrick.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3613.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Lisa Smart, author of Words at the Threshold. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about what we say as we're nearing death.
Nika nanantua pitet tatyung nalilong ispantatamip napwehat sipo maluatok napagatan tatyung Quahakwan nanogotum. Nakso nanogotum.